Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Hello, I'm John Elledge, and this is Skylines, the Cinemetric Podcast. Well, sort of. This is going to be a repeat. It's been a bit of a busy week. I'm about to move house. I've just been on a reporting trip to Peterborough, which was, it's as exciting as a reporting trip to Peterborough can be. That piece will be coming out in the next couple of weeks. If you're someone who follows me on social media, you may notice that I've got a new job. I'm still going to be doing Cinemetric, but I'm also going to be main editor of the New Statesman's website, which is very exciting to kind of get this promotion and have all these new responsibilities. So still working out how that's going to go. But the result of this is one thing or another. I've just not had time to actually get a podcast together. So I tweeted an apology for this. And a guy called Paul Frame said, well, why don't you just put out an old one? And that's a good idea. So it's something I've been thinking about for a while, because a lot of the earlier episodes were put out at the time when we had an audience significantly smaller than the one we've got now. So statistically speaking, you probably haven't heard this one. And a lot of those early episodes, for one reason or another, I'm quite proud of. We had a proper producer at the time, who you may have heard in the podcast, a guy called Royfield Brown. I had a co-host, Stephanie Boland, at this point. And this was an episode that I was quite pleased with. We're talking about the different experiences that men and women have at the city, with guests including Caroline Criado Perez, the feminist campaigner, and Lauren Elkin, the author of the book Flaneurs. So, this is from August 2016. Enjoy. I'll be back with a new episode next week.
This podcast is a Royfield Brown production. Find others on iTunes.
All right. Yeah, I know.
This is a Manhattan-bound B Express train. The next stop is Grand Street.
Mind the gap.
Welcome to Skylines, the Cinemetric Podcast. I'm John.
And I'm Stephanie. And this week we're talking about cities and gender.
You don't think of the design of cities as something automatically that's going to discriminate against women.
This new, well-educated, English-speaking community has taken over the city.
Wow, it's so much more comfortable to walk in boots.
So, not a lot of people realise this about me. I kept it a bit quiet, but I am, in fact, a man. And yeah, that makes me different from you, Stephanie, because you're not a man. In fact, I think it's fair to say that you are, in fact, a woman. So, how's that working out for you?
It's hit and miss, to be honest, John, because, obviously there's some good things about being a woman. I'm allowed to cry in public and read Emma McBride, but there are bad things like living in a patriarchy. And that extends into cities. We don't currently have a kind of zoning charge for sexism, although Sadiq, you know, get on it.
Cities are very much part of the patriarchy, are they? We haven't got like the patriarchy isn't a geographical phenomenon.
No, much like every other part of the world, the city is a patriarchal space.
Okay, so how... I'm going to have to edit this.
I think you should include all the laughing.
Yeah, so, okay, how does living in the patriarchy manifest itself in the urban world? Kind of give us a typical morning's commute, maybe.
Oh, how long have we got? So I live in Whitechapel in East London, which is...
Full of hipsters.
Well, not my little bits, actually full of kind of Bengali grandmothers, which is really nice. We have a lot of property that's been owned by Bengali families for generations, so the developers are baying at the door but haven't yet been able to buy most of it.
So what you're saying is the bit of East London you live in is pretty obscure and I wouldn't have heard of it.
Well, I mean, it's Whitechapel. It's okay. You know, our international listeners might know it for the Jack the Ripper murders. That tends to be what people have heard of in Whitechapel, but we've also got, you know, bagels and other good things. So as I leave my front door, actually, no, it starts before that, because if you're a woman living in the city, one of the first things you have to consider is what to wear for the day. I hear men also get dressed, but it has a very specific import for women in that what you wear and how you present yourself is always a bit of a negotiation. And whether or not you do get harassed more or less depending on what you're wearing, I've never been able to tell precisely, but it's still a consideration. So you get dressed, you leave the house. Sometimes you get catcalled in the mornings. I think it should be illegal to catcall people before 9 a.m. because I'm just too grumpy to deal with it.
There's a danger that if you do that, then it's just going to encourage people. It's like, right, 9:05, here we go.
Begin the catcalls. Yeah. Then you go to the tube. We earn 77% of a man's income on average, so you pay for your tube fare out of your diminished salary. I'm really banging on here, but... And then you get on the tube, not frequently, but definitely occasionally enough that it is part of the lived experience of being in a city. Somebody will either try and talk to you on the tube, which maybe should also be outlawed for everyone, perhaps. I know you don't like people talking to you on the tube.
Or anywhere else, ideally.
Sometimes, you know, I know a lot of women who live in London who have been groped on the tube or various other kind of horrible things have happened to them, mostly at the hands of male commuters. It's just a litany of misery. I promise my mornings are quite cheerful.
To what extent do you think being in an urban environment kind of exacerbates this stuff? Like, do you think there is something specific about cities that makes it more likely, or do you think it's just kind of the density of incident and experience?
I think it is, yeah. I think there's the density of incident and experience in that you are at very close quarters with a lot of people, which means you have interactions with a lot more people. But I also think the city provides certain freedoms for women which might not be so simple elsewhere. So it is relatively easy for me to get home at night. I'm very lucky in where I live, in that there are busy transport routes back to my house. And definitely when I lived in the countryside, that was more of a concern. I'd have to walk with my keys in my hand. So it works. It works both ways, I think.
I mean, that's so often the case with stuff about how cities function. They are sort of a heightened version of what you get everywhere else, really. See, I really don't have to think about most of this stuff. It's not that nobody ever talks to me on public transport, but, you know, it's a rarity, and it's also, it's not that threatening when they do, because I'm kind of a big lad. I do think about what I wear, because I'm pretentious, but it doesn't actually sort of make a difference with how people engage with me particularly. Although I have occasionally been on television wearing some terribly loud shirts, which I should really sort of think about. First of all,
I hope probably. Women kind of mock you when you do this.
Yeah.
I have confidence in them.
I'm reasonably well. I mean, like most of our desk upstairs are women, and I'm married, so I'm pretty well mocked. Don't worry about that. There's no shortage of women in my life to mock me.
It is the New Statesman offices, maybe one of the few places which are a patriarchy free zone, at least the web desk, because I feel like we've just stacked the gender divide so in favour of women.
Yeah, I'm the only white man on the New Statesman web desk and have been for well over a year at this point, so which is great. I get to be the sort of sink for everyone's rage against patriarchy, which is, you know, that's my cross to bear. It's not really making up for, you know, 10,000 years of gender oppression.
Well, you know, you go one step at a time.
Yeah, but I think the thing that I'm most struck by about the difference between my experience and yours is the street harassment thing, which is now sort of spilled over into the social media harassment thing. I can remember being with my then girlfriend like 15 years ago when she kind of got yelled at by some guys in the street. And I just thought, that's a bit weird. That's not off. Don't turn this bugger off. And it was years later. It was the point when Twitter was a thing and suddenly you kind of have this window into everyone else's world that, like, I sort of realised this is just a standard part of a woman's experience most days. And I had no idea this was happening. I remember talking about this with my friend Tom and he was the same. It's like, who are these men who are doing this? Who thinks this? But it's clearly, you know, it's clearly a lot of them?
It's a lot of them in my experience. Often the same men who are on Twitter going, who does this? Are the men who do it.
I mean, probably.
Every woman could name names if she had to.
Okay. I have been known to mansplain stuff. That is a thing I do. let's not delude ourselves there. But I'm reasonably certain I have never randomly shouted at a woman in the street. I think...
Unless she was kind of talking about the green belt and...
Well, she was asking for it. I don't know, that's probably shouldn't joke about that.
This idea of catcalling is an interesting thing because, as in so many other situations, you know, women in cities are looked at and yet also weirdly invisible, in that you feel yourself watched and you feel the weight of the male gaze, but your experiences aren't really testified to until you have a space like Twitter or until you start, you know, walking around with a boyfriend who then notices it.
Yeah, so how do we improve the visibility of this, do you reckon? What can we do?
Well, one gesture that ActionAid tried back in spring was to get 30 mannequins and mark a third of them in red and place them in central London. So the 1 in 3 statistic refers to the number of women who reportedly will experience violence at the hands of men. And by putting that physically in the landscape, the hope was to raise attention to the fact that, you know, there is this whole lived experience that a significant minority of women go through that isn't talked about or seen or visible.
And we had a piece sort of triggered by this campaign on City Metric in which a leading feminist journalist wrote about some of the issues women face in the world of city planning.
And we're lucky enough to have her.
This is a Brooklyn-bound A express train. The next stop is Dyckman Street. This is a 125th Street-bound A express train. The next stop is 59th Street, Columbus Circle.
My name's Caroline Criado-Perez. I am a writer, and I wrote an article for City Metric about designing cities with women's needs in mind.
Okay, so can we talk about this, the genesis of that article?
Safer Cities for Women Day. I'm not sure that that's an actual real day.
I mean, none of these things are real days.
That's not true. Some of them are... Since I've got interested in the way in which women are sort of excluded from everything, pretty much, like all kinds of research, all kinds of design, I've started looking at lots of different official days to mark them in the calendar so that I can look into them when they come up and to see, aha, this is where the male default is screwing women over in this instance, because that is how fun my life is.
So did you run into, were you kind of walking through Marble Arch and you saw these things looming up, or was it a picture?
No, they actually got in touch with me and told me that they were doing it. So it was, yeah, Safer Cities for Women Day, and they had 30 mannequins, a third of them were marked in red to symbolise the 1 in 3 women who will experience male violence in her lifetime. And obviously women don't only experience violence in cities, but that just sort of got me thinking about the connection between the discrimination of women and city design. And it's something that I had come across before, the idea that cities are not designed around women, with particular reference to safety. So, for example, there are, you know, if you don't design with women in mind in terms of lighting or in terms of having a sense that it's not an enclosed space, that women can't be seen easily, women might feel less safe. Whether or not they actually are less safe isn't actually that relevant. It's about restricting women's movement because of the idea that women are always told, you know, don't go down that alleyway, don't go there on your own. So the idea of restricting women's movement in that way. So I wanted to look into it and to see whether there were other ways in which women's movement or women's lives were restricted by something as seemingly innocuous, as seemingly egalitarian as city design. You know, you don't think of the design of cities as something automatically that's going to discriminate against women, particularly if, you know, you're just treating everyone the same. Everyone uses the same roads, everyone uses the same transport. We're all human beings. Why would it be different for women? But it is.
Okay, so let's unpack that a little. What is the actual problem with just sort of going, hey, why can't we just design for, like, people, ma'am? Why do you need to think about women? Like, what's the difficulty there?
Well, because women are not exactly the same as men. Women are often brought up differently. They have different life experiences. They also have different bodies. And so, therefore, inevitably, if you build something around one particular type of human, you often end up discriminating against another kind of human, even without meaning to. So, for example, as a general rule, men tend to be taller than women. So there's this famous human scale by a Swiss architect called Le Corbusier, I think, who, you know, set this traditional human scale for architecture. Well, it turns out that the human scale is based around a 6-foot human. Most women aren't 6 foot tall. I mean, actually, most men aren't 6 foot tall, but they're more likely to be 6 foot tall than a woman. So that's just one example. I mean, that's not going to be huge. That's going to be things like, you know, things are too high for her, or things are not, like, I don't know, the loo is hung too high or something like that. It's not going to kill you. But there are other examples that are just as sort of seemingly small that actually end up having a much bigger impact on women's lives. And one of the ones I thought was most interesting was the snow clearing schedule in a city called Karlskoga in Sweden, where they were looking at various ways in which they ran their city, and they wanted to figure out in what way were they, without meaning to, discriminating against women, making life harder for women. They found lots of ways that weren't that surprising, for example, transport. But supposedly where the snow clearing schedule came up was as a joke, as just a kind of, well, at least snow clearing is gender neutral and we won't have to worry about that. And unfortunately for them, that got the gender people thinking. And it turned out that actually it is gendered. So they looked at the schedule, what was cleared first, and they found that they cleared the major road arteries first and they were clearing the pavements last. And actually, because men and women tend to move around the city differently, so women are more likely to use public transport and more likely to walk, and they're more likely to make more complex and shorter journeys throughout the day.
It sounds like one of those things where once you think about it, you have that, my mind's opening up listening to you talk about it now, where if you clear major thoroughfares first, you're also going, commuting to work is more important than domestic labour. So you know, it immediately sets off all of these big alarm bells.
Exactly.
Right?
So, that is the reason for which women's types of journeys are different to men's types of journeys. But as a sort of repercussion of that, once they decided, okay, let's stop prioritising men, let's start prioritising women and cyclists and wheelchair users and all sorts of people who aren't going to be doing this twice daily commute, they found that hospital admissions for falls as a result of icy conditions fell dramatically, which wasn't something that they'd been expecting. And it isn't something that you'd automatically expect until you sort of think about it and think, well, yeah, actually, you are more likely to slip as a person than a car is.
And can on the note of public transport, can I ask about buses? Because you mentioned this scheme in, apologies, I'm probably going to mispronounce the city now, is it Kalmar? In India, I think, where they say they've arranged for buses to make stops between kind of official bus stops if you want to get off somewhere safe.
I think this one was...
is that also in Sweden?
That was also Sweden.
Oh, it's always Sweden doing good stuff, isn't
it? Sweden are really good. Vienna is quite good also.
So what is it? So because that would revolutionise the lives of people anyway, if you could kind of, if your bus became part cab after a certain hour, I mean, that would be incredible, right? You could...
Oh my God, I've just realised I had a dream last night about this. This is so tragic. I had a dream that there was a bus service that actually did that. Although I think it was less for violence against women reasons and more for...
not carrying
things home. The other night I had to walk and almost missed the last tube and it was all very stressful.
I did dream an increase in frequency on the London Overground line between Romford and Upminster the other week. That is literally a dream I had. So it's possible I've been doing this job too long.
Right in with your best city metric dreams.
Yeah. anyway.
But yeah, I mean, that ties into what I was saying right at the beginning about it's not necessarily always about actual risk of violence, given that we live in a world in which one in three women will experience violence against women in her lifetime, and women are taught that it is their responsibility to avoid violence. By having areas that don't seem well lit, or expecting women to walk back in, you know, get off the bus stop and in a place that seems unsafe, that is limiting her ability to, you know, move around the city, to have a social life, to engage in all the sorts of things that you kind of imagine would be a normal way of experiencing a city, normal way of living in a city. And that's, you know, that's as important as whether or not violence actually is increasing. So, for example, when councils across the UK started off switching off lights as a result of cost-saving exercises, there was a lot of research into whether or not it actually did increase violence. And it looks like violence hasn't actually increased, but what has increased is women are feeling unsafe as they walk down the street, and therefore, you know, that is curtailing their ability to move around. Mm. And that's a really important part of women's lives, the fear that we're expected to move around with.
You also wonder as well if people are reporting that, you know, it is changing how they experience the city. Well, maybe violence hasn't increased because people have stopped doing those journeys. And therefore people aren't out in public space. And that's a sad kind of fine. Your statistics look the same, but at the cost of kind of people's freedom.
That's really interesting. And I hadn't actually thought of that. And it's definitely something worth
looking
into.
Isn't it?
Yeah.
To what extent Do we think the problem here is that the kind of people who want to spend their careers doing things like city planning and playing with transport maps and so on, the map impulse is a very male thing. It's like,
is it?
I think it fits with a certain type of male obsessiveness. I think, like, generally speaking, like, there are more men listening to this podcast than women, because just the more men are that kind of nerd. It's not universal, but it is a bit gendered, and I just wondered if that's feeding into, like, men are therefore more likely to be doing the jobs where they make these decisions.
I'm sure that that's part of it. I just was struck by the idea that maps are necessary gendered, because doesn't everyone love old maps and weird maps and funny maps? They're always really popular, aren't they?
Yeah, I mean, but I think it's, I don't know, maybe I'm just reading across from me and Barbara Speed, where, like, I was the one who got really excited about maps, and she kind of roll her eyes slightly and be like, oh, John's at it again.
I really love maps.
Is that gendered?
there has actually been research on this, I think. Like, men are more likely to get really weirdly into maps. It's the train spotting impulse, basically.
Yeah.
But there are more men kind of working in this field.
No,
like,
there are.
That's the point
it is absolutely
kind of going towards.
I don't dispute your point. I just wondered specifically about the maps, and that wasn't like a loaded question. I just genuinely would be interested to know.
Caroline later, starting with a bit where she actually answers the question I just asked her, you know, in typical male fashion. I'm just kind of interrupting at this point to talk about something else. But that interview was a few weeks ago now, and ever since then she's been sending me links to things suggesting that women are also interested in maps. Just, you know, demonstrating that perhaps I'm a little bit wrong about that one. For example, Caroline sent me a link to a BBC News story about a very fashionable silk dress made up from the design of a World War II escape map.
Oh, it's like a dog walking on its hind legs hearing you say fashionable silk dress.
I know, it's a bloody dress. What do you want me to say? It's like, you know,
so it's made up of World War II maps. Sorry, tell us about the dress.
It's got a map on it. It's a dress with a map on it. What more do you want?
It's true. That is a good gateway drug to get women into maps, because if you put it on a dress, they might become interested.
Yeah, maybe a handbag.
That could be good.
Or
yeah, or a lip. Can you get a map on lip? It's too small.
I don't know.
Lipstick
maybe
map?
Not, probably not the whole tube. But yeah, as you could probably tell, Caroline was slightly cynical about my belief that map obsession was a peculiarly male form of nerdery. So I've been sort of doing a bit of Googling to check on the state of the research. One thing that does actually, there does seem to be some truth to, is that men do have better spatial awareness than women. There's reasonably sort of clear research to back that up. What's not clear, though, is whether that's kind of genetic or
learned,
whether it's the way we're socialised.
I would love to see the research on how you figure out whether it's natural or learned. Like, you could put babies in a maze.
Yeah, that would be amazing.
Hey, amazing.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
I'm doing that thing you kept doing the other week where I'm giving you a look and then expecting the listeners to comprehend that. But yes, so there is some evidence that for whatever reason, men do have a better spatial sense than women. But what I couldn't find is anything to back up my assumption that this means that men are, in fact, more interested in maps than women. And in the middle of the point where Caroline and I were still having this debate on Twitter, I got an email from someone in Berlin called Sarah telling me that she listened to the podcast because she shared my obsessive love of maps, and that Barbara was wrong about maps. So anyway, Sarah is also one of the three members of the Berlinials podcast, and they've been kind enough to record a segment about Berlin for us.
I'm Sarah.
And we are two-thirds of the Berlinials, and we're going to be talking about why Berlin is such a great city.
We are indeed. So why is Berlin so awesome?
Because it is poor, but sexy.
And what makes you say that?
I didn't say it.
Who did?
Klaus Wowereit, who is the former mayor of Berlin. And I think, in a way, it's still true, and it encapsulates a lot of things about Berlin. It's a very cheap city to live in, which mm-hmm. I think is why we have such a big expat community, mm-hmm. a big startup scene, a big artistic scene, which also means that there's just a lot of cool stuff to do.
Yeah. I mean, this is it. It's also a very open city. It's got a huge gay community. It's very tolerant. It's very left-wing.
Public transport is great. You also don't need to speak German, which is ideal. I mean, as someone who arrived not speaking German,
exactly.
It was ideal.
Yeah, it does feed into some of the bigger problems that Berlin has got, having such a large international community.
Yeah, and this will thrill your sociology heart, Sarah. So the two big problems, we're going to talk a little bit about its gentrification and integration.
Yeah, which they are thrilling topics. So gentrification in Berlin is much behind where things are currently in London. But it is on the increase. There's no way around that, is there?
Yeah, I mean, I think in a way it's a natural thing that a lot of big cities have to deal with as they expand and develop. Mm-hmm. But it's a particularly acute issue in Berlin because you've noticed, I guess, in the past 10 years, in the past 5 years, that as we have a growing international community and it's becoming a more attractive city to live in, rent has gone up dramatically, mm-hmm. as one prime example, which means that a lot of families and people who, you know, let's say, used to be able to afford renting a flat in Kreuzberg or something are now being, you know...
completely unable to rent.
Yeah,
Kreuzberg's very expensive.
Yeah.
And this comes coupled with some problems with integration. For example, if you do walk around Kreuzberg now on a Monday afternoon or whatever, there's a good chance you won't hear any German, not a word, and the people in the shops won't speak German. And that's a source of some pain for some Berliners, I think.
Yeah, in a way, you know, it's a bit surreal
that
you're living in Germany, because if you go to any other city outside of Berlin, I think you really notice that you are living in such a bubble.
Yeah, and it is a bubble, and it can cause problems and frustrations amongst people that have been here for the longer time, that this new, well-educated, English-speaking community has taken over the city. For example, simpler things like the anti-tourist t-shirts and the anti-tourist sentiment.
Anti-gentrification graffiti.
Uh-huh. Being shouted at occasionally to speak German by old people on buses.
Yeah. Or just bus drivers.
Or bus drivers.
Passive-aggressively yelling at you in German.
But there are some more frightening themes starting to develop. In my neck of the woods in the north of Berlin, in Wedding, I recently encountered AfD flyer people.
Yeah, which is a fringe right-wing party, I guess, similar to UKIP?
Yeah, very similar to UKIP, possibly more deranged.
Yeah, but I mean, I would say, you know, you maybe get incidents of some attacks, let's say, or growing popularity of more close-minded parties, but mm-hmm. I think these are still very isolated incidents, and Berlin, I still think, is a great city to live in, and if you come with an open mind and also try yourself to integrate and learn more about German culture, apart from beer drinking.
Yeah, and learn some German, you just got to, sorry.
Yeah.
Yeah.
If you need some help with German, we have some excellent German words of the week.
We do. We do that on our podcast. It comes out about once a month. We're on iTunes, we're on Omni.
Yeah, Berlinials, Instagram, Twitter, whatever other youth-driven social media channels.
We trust you can use Google.
Yes.
All right. Cheers.
Cheers.
So we've talked a bit about the practical side of women living in cities, but there's also a cultural side to this as well, because as John touched on, a lot of how we negotiate cities is to do with learned experience as well as just the objective facts of how things are laid out. So to find out a bit more about this, I spoke to Lauren Elkin, the author of Flaneuse, a book all about women walking in cities.
Hi, I'm Lauren Elkin. I'm the author of the recently published Flaneuse, Women Walk the City in Paris, New York, Tokyo, Venice and London.
Yeah, so I guess, you've written this book, which is has been really successful. It's being serialised on Radio 4 at the moment, which must be so exciting. Why did you decide to write about women and walking?
It came about because, it sort of had two initial moments of sort of rising to the surface and feeling like this is something I had to write about. And the first one was when I was at university in my final year and was in a senior seminar called The Man in the Street. The Man in the Crowd, The Woman in the Street. And I was like, ooh, The Woman in the Street. I had just come back from Paris from studying abroad. And this was just such a rich and suggestive idea to me. Who was this woman in the street and what was she doing there? And so I really wanted to write about the female flâneur, because I'd just been in Paris sort of flaneuring around and sort of discovering the joys of just walking idly in the city. And so I, as a sort of senior project, I thought I could formalize this and talk about women who walked in cities. And I had a sort of list I was going to write on Jean Rhys and Colette and Virginia Woolf. And then as I started getting into the secondary research, I just kept coming up against all of these feminist critics, lots of them were art historians, claiming that there could be no flâneuse, that the concept was just an impossibility because of the way that the flâneur himself was codified in the mid-19th century, that being a time when women just didn't have, the leisure or the time or the freedom to, walk in the streets the way that a man did. So it was like, because the flâneur did this thing that women couldn't do at the time when Baudelaire kind of codified the flâneur, therefore there could be no flâneuse. And that struck me as like just a sort of problematic argument, one that made sense in its historicized moment, but that didn't sort of make transhistoric sense. So at the time, in the late 90s, I didn't have the wherewithal to speak back to those art historians. But when I finished my PhD a few years ago and thought, what kind of project do I want to do now? What feels like really kind of worthwhile and important? I thought, women and visibility and the right to public space and just the joys of strolling in the city.
And that's something you complicate so well in this book, because it's not only women can go out and be in city space, even if they have to navigate things differently or get treated differently, they are out there doing it, and in fact have been for a while. But also you complicate this idea that men go out and aren't looked at. I know there's a moment where you go back to a Baudelaire poem and kind of go, there's an interloper in these writings too, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that was that. I think I'm sort of suspicious of binaries where we say, men do this and women do that, this, and, the ways in which people present in public are fraught and complicated. And, in recent years, we're sort of seeing this sort of a growing of awareness around the trans movement and this idea that, maybe we shouldn't be trying to pin down people according to some grid that we have of what gender is. Maybe it's this kind of spectrum. So I was thinking about those issues as I was writing the book and coming across, a figure like George Sand. I can't remember who is it, maybe Griselda Pollock or Patricia Ferguson, who's saying that George Sand, because she was cross-dressing, couldn't be a flâneuse because she was dressed as a man. And it's like, I don't know. Surely she's opening up some other space for women to signify that's sort of in between male and female, and using that interspace as a sort of place of freedom and a place of mobility. So I was trying to play with it, this idea that people think they know what they're looking at when they look at us in the street, but really we might be up to something completely different.
Can we talk a bit about George Sand, because it's this brilliant chapter in the book where you kind of go back and excavate this history of her in the street and watching other people in the street. Can you just kind of
for people who haven't read the book yet or heard it on the radio so far, what drew you to her?
There's this great passage in her autobiography where she talks about how right after she moved to Paris, she had left her husband and her children behind at the family estate, Noël, and found that it was actually really difficult to walk around the city in her like fancy women's clothing, all of these crinolines and, you know, skirts and little dainty shoes and her little stupid hat. Her feet would hurt. She couldn't get anywhere. People looked at her strange. So she had a redingote made for herself, like one of those old, you know, men's coats with the long tails, and bought a pair of boots like her brother had, and made some breeches for herself and put them on. And then she's like, wow, it's so much more comfortable to walk in boots instead of in little women's shoes. It was so her sort of decision to walk in the city was, or desire to walk in the city was augmented by the fact that she was able to sort of find these very pragmatic, you know, bits of clothing. And she writes about it with such, like, I don't know, she's so kind of funny. And it reminded me a bit of Virginia Woolf, who in her essay Street Haunting says, when we step out into the street, we leave behind all the things that make us ourselves. And George Sand was saying, in my redingcoat and my man's boots, I could disappear into the crowd. I was like an atom lost in the crowd. And that those are like really familiar sort of tropes for being in this city. That idea of being either subsumed into the crowd or wanting to preserve your individuality within the crowd. That's that kind of, you know, Georg Simmel, you know, kind of tension. And so here were women feeling this tension just the way, you know, that men were. So this seems like the basis of my argument for me. And that came from her autobiography.
What about kind of, I mean, we have to talk about Paris at some point because it's such a big part of this book is your move to Paris. And the title comes from kind of manipulating French words and is based on your experiences studying abroad. Is there something about, you know, when you're in a place which is foreign or foreign to your own experience, you reassess how you're moving in space?
Yeah, because if you're sort of in a new environment, then you suddenly become extremely aware of yourself in space. And, you know, that can either feel like a nice challenge and very exciting, and you sort of learn your way around and learn how your body feels in this new place, the way you respond to like the weather and the lighting and, you know, whatever. Or it can go the other way and you just sort of feel like forever uncomfortable. I mean, maybe I'm just excessively sensitive to space and place. I think there's probably a healthier response might be to just sort of go where you're going and do what you're doing. But, you know, I think there's something really kind of inspiring and empowering that can come from sort of becoming attuned to where you are and to how it feels to be there. And yeah, I mean, for instance, when I went to Tokyo, that was a place where I didn't feel at all comfortable. And that ended up being this wonderful kind of challenge, you know, to not sort of just disembark in this place and go, I just don't like it, you know, which is how I sounded the first, like, probably 6 months or something, really kind of spoiled and entitled and like, I don't like this place. It's icky and the food is gross. But to try to use that kind of point of conflict as a way to move beyond, you know, your own kind of assumptions or needs when you get to a new place.
So if you could give a kind of call to arms, would that be it, that we should all go and kind of do that slight psychogeographer thing of looking at where we are and...
Yeah, I think so. I think, sorry, my, I still have this cold. My voice sounds.
I feel cold. Like we should explain to our listeners that you're very bravely doing this through a cold.
Yeah, it's. I'm finding all these new nooks and crannies in my voice. I didn't know were there. I don't know. So much more tricksy and subversive to sort of confronting your dislike for a place and saying, okay, why do I dislike this? Where is this coming from? And how can I use this as a sort of way to key into whatever is causing the friction. That might sound really abstract and vague. I don't know. But in Tokyo, it was more a question of like, I really dislike these, you know, buildings. Maybe the answer is not to recoil into myself, but to like go inside them and see what there is and go up these stairs and up these elevators and, you know, really kind of thoroughly exhaust them. And if you still hate them, you still hate them, but at least you've tried.
Yeah, and I think that's such a familiar thing to anyone who travels, where especially somewhere where you don't have language, it's so easy to kind of go, I'm just not going to deal with any of this.
Yeah, exactly. It's true.
Doors are closing. station, Changi Airport.
So now we're going to go back to our conversation with Caroline Criado Perez. You may recall that at the point we cut it off, I just asked her whether the problem was that more men are involved in city planning than women.
That is a huge part of the problem. It's an incredibly male-dominated industry, both in terms of engineers, construction industry, town planning, architecture, and of course local government as well. So all those areas that feed into the way that a city is planned and built is massively dominated by men. And the problem with that, of course, is that men don't have an experience of what it's like to navigate a city as a woman. So, for example, they are less likely to have the kind of caring responsibilities that change the way a woman, the kind of journeys a woman has to make. They don't experience the level of fear of violence that women are going to experience. I mean, another one that I thought was really interesting was the parks in Vienna that I alluded to briefly earlier, which was where they looked at how children were using the park, and they found that, I think it was up to about the age of 9, boys and girls were using it equally. But after that age, girls stopped using it. And it wasn't because girls didn't want to use the park, it's because the way that the park space was divided up meant that girls and boys had to compete. And around that age is the age that boys start to, I guess, exert their masculinity in a way that girls find intimidating. And so the girls didn't really want to compete with the boys for space, and so they just didn't even bother. And they found that once they subdivided the park up into smaller spaces, the girls came back to the park. That's something that, for example, those boys don't realise that they're doing that, and they're not deliberately trying to keep the girls out. So when those boys grow up to be men, they won't have the experience of feeling that they had that space taken away from them, whereas girls would. And so that's something that you might think about. I mean, there's an outdoor gym, for example, in Hampstead Heath, and the number of times that, you know, I think I'll go for a run and then I might finish off in the outdoor gym. If there's a whole bunch of men just sort of hanging out there doing their pull-ups and whatever and being blokey, I won't go in because I feel intimidated, I feel unwelcome, I feel like they would be like, oh, that's this bloody woman coming in here doing it, and I don't back myself to be enough to do enough pull-ups to get away with it. And they won't realise that they're keeping me out. They have no idea that they're keeping me out, but they are. So it's about being aware of those moments, having experienced those things, that makes you aware of how you might want to change the way you design things.
I wonder if there are specific, because I know Sadiq Khan, the new London mayor, has appointed far more women on his team than I think people were kind of expecting him to. I think he might have a female-dominated top team. You will know this, John.
I should know this, but I don't.
But I think he's kind of, you know, recruited
he's
more women than
well.
Ordinarily. I wonder if there's a list of recommendations you could send to him and kind of go,
oh, that's an idea. well, currently I'm trying to convince him to let me put a statue up in Parliament Square. So once I've dealt with that
Once
demand,
you've done the statue, you can then sort the transport
exactly.
system.
But I think that's another part of it, isn't it? It's about our built environment and, you know, what history we learn about as we walk around the city. Do we see a city dominated by old dead white men, or do we see a city dominated by people who look like us and who make us think that, you know, we can also be part of the public space? Because it's about, you know, it's about that, it's about who belongs in the public space, and historically, of course, women have not been allowed in the public space.
I know, much as I love the Tony Benn plaque in Parliament in the crypt, I still, of course, the woman plaque is in the cupboard.
What's the plaque in the cupboard? I don't know. This
Emily Welding Davison
spent census night one year in hiding in a cupboard off the crypt, I think it is, and so she could register her address as the Houses of Parliament in the census. And Tony Blair Tony Benn snuck down and put a plaque in, so it's in one of the cupboards in Parliament.
It is. I've been into the cupboard. I took a selfie.
was there light in there? Okay, that's an irrelevant question.
What was the lighting situation? Yeah.
The lighting wasn't very good. It was a very small cupboard. That
did
they
you
had
use flash? You had to.
Actually, you're not allowed to take photographs. Photography is not allowed in the cupboard. But yeah, they're storing like printer cartridges or something. It's really not very, it's not a very hallowed space.
Okay, to round this off, I think there's kind of an example, well, something I'm wondering is possibly could be an example of this kind of gender differential planning, which is toilets.
Yes.
Which it's another one of those sort of cliches that seem to be true, that like there are always queues for women's toilets but not for men's ones.
Yes.
And I wonder if there is a planning cause of that, where they're dedicating equal space to the two, but they don't actually require equal space. To yeah. get kind of equal efficiency, you should be dedicating more space to the female toilets.
I think the rule that they've developed that all buildings should now incorporate is that there should be double the number of female toilets as there are male toilets for exactly that reason. But that's just not the way most places do it. It's pretty bad in the UK, for example, where, you know, there are all these long queues and public conveniences keep closing. There's one near me, which has been turned into a really cool bar, which is nice.
Not that hygienic one, no, thing, but, you know,
I guess they bleached it. I've actually not been into it. I keep meaning to go into it. But yeah, it's a huge problem in countries like, for example, India, where in a typical Mumbai slum, there are around 6 toilets per 8,000 women. Many of these are infested with rats and don't have running water, and women are often raped or assaulted as they search for a toilet. And the problem beyond the obvious with that is that women are therefore not using the toilet, and they're developing all sorts of urinary tract infections and kidney problems because there is nowhere for them to pee safely. And it's such a basic thing. And it is just much easier for men to just whip it out and go wherever they want to, which I'm not suggesting is something that men want to do around London. I'd rather they didn't. But, you know, they do have that option. It's just not really an option for women. Another, it's not really related to city design, but something that I've come across again and again when it comes to things like uniforms for women in the military, or women in wetsuits, for example, in Greenpeace and things like that, is that none of these things are designed to make it easy for a woman to go to the loo. So she's got to take the whole thing off, whereas they've always got like a little flap for the men. So that's just, it's nothing to do with cities. It's just something that I find interesting.
Although if you ever want to be a woman and get no queue for the toilets and feel very smug, you know, that you're in a city watching men queue for ages, go to your nearest football stadium. And at half time, there is never any queue for the women's loos.
That actually reminds me, I was at a conference just the other day, which was, you know, obviously about women and equality. And obviously the vast majority of people there were women. And of course, when the, you know, the break came, everyone ran to the loos, and there was this massive queue snaking around the corner, and no one was going into the men's loos. So I just sort of thought, well, I'm going to go in the men's loos because this is really stupid. When I came out, the person in charge of the building was waiting for me to tell me off, to say that I wasn't allowed to go into the men's loos. Just the logic is just astounding.
It's a safe space.
There were no men there.
So to relieve my burden as the sole representative of the female gender, although, you know, I'm happy to take it on if you all are, we asked on Twitter what women would change about their cities to make them feel safer and just generally more pleasant to live in. And we got some great responses.
Yeah, the thing that struck me about this actually was that the vast majority of responses were in fact from women, because I really thought this was going to backfire and we were going to get loads of men sort of complaining in some way. Just because I've been to the internet before, really. And I was pleasantly surprised that relatively few stuck their oar in at this point.
Yeah. No, a few of them did come to argue, but they mostly tagged out City Metric and just addressed it to me, which is... But we did...
I mean, that feels like a very telling story, actually, doesn't it? Okay.
But we did get a lot of women coming with suggestions that range from potentially controversial to things that could actually be quite minor. So Marie Leconte, who writes for BuzzFeed, has suggested a curfew for men to stop men from being outdoors after 9 p.m. unless accompanied by a woman.
Molly Goodfellow from Sky News suggests more taxis driven by women, or a women-only taxi service, which I thought was quite a nice idea.
I think that'd be fantastic. Laurie Penny makes the point, Laurie Penny, contributing editor at The New Statesman, makes the point that humane and reasonable rents, allowing his actual choice over where and with whom we live, would make a big difference for her. And then Neve Navulan says better cycle infrastructure would also be nice, because abuse and intimidation from drivers is a nasty bit of her life. And both of those I found quite interesting, in that what we're potentially seeing is that things that benefit everyone benefit women more, in that women stand to suffer more when things aren't great.
Yeah, no, I thought that was quite telling, that both of those were just general points of that if we design the city better, it will get it will particularly improve for women. Someone called Naomi suggests a navigational app which recommends the safest streets to use for walking or cycling home at night. Someone popped up to suggest that Naomi look at a safety pin app and harassmap.org. So.
Oh, fantastic. This is when I love Twitter, when you kind of post and somebody else already has the answer. Rosie Fletcher says something quite interesting because she talks again about no advertising, which is an interesting thing. I think people maybe don't realise how hostile advertising feels when you're kind of going through the tube and you pass 20 pictures of women, you know, with their breasts out, or kind of advertising cars, or just generally objectifying in grotesque ways. But she also says we should have more public shaming of gropers, leers, and perverts. This is one of the things that men, if you're listening, this is maybe a relatively easy thing to do, is that, you know, the more men, when they feel safe to do so, call out other men, the easier you make women's lives.
Something that did strike me about this is that we didn't get... There aren't really any funny answers. Like, normally we do this bit and it's kind of an excuse to read out funny tweets, and actually everyone's just coming up with genuinely
well-thought-through
policy ideas, which is brilliant.
And telling.
Yeah.
We also had some fantastic ones about cleaning up pavements and things like that, because, you know, I'm the oldest of four people. Women disproportionately in our society bear the brunt of childcare. If you're trying to get a pushchair or a hyperactive toddler down the street, even something like dog poo on the street is going to bother you more than if you're on your own, walking at speed, able to dart around a bit. Everything is about women, is what we're learning here.
Yeah, we had a few people pop up to complain about men urinating on the street, which is gross. I mean, let's not beat around the bush on that one. That's just disgusting.
Well, more public toilets in general, and more public toilets for women. Yeah,
I mean, actually, public toilets are a great example of this kind of thing where it would be a massive benefit for everyone, but particularly for women, and you really don't have to think hard about that to see why.
Yeah.
Something that a few people proposed was stronger punishments for men that urinate in the street. Emma Brooks says, I keep seeing it this week and it's gross. I don't know why particularly this week, but...
Yeah, no, it is both highly irritating, partially on a jealousy level, because men can urinate in the street, but also because the public urinals in Piccadilly Gardens in Manchester make my eyes water, and I blame patriarchy
You're
for this.
You're obsessed with these public urinals.
I really am. This is my number one city bugbear.
The things you're going to get on every episode of this podcast is going to be something to do with football and urinals.
I'm basically going to turn this podcast into a campaign platform for my campaign to remove the public urinals from Piccadilly Gardens.
Yeah, I hope you're listening, Andy Burnham. You've been listening to Skylines, the City Metric podcast. It was presented by John Illich and Stephanie Boland and produced by Royfield Brown. You can contact all three of us on Twitter, where there's a pretty good chance we'll talk back. Our theme music was Waves by CORTR. You also heard We Are One by Vixento. All music in the show was licensed under Creative Commons. You can find Skylines every 2 weeks on Acast, on iTunes, or in the podcatcher of your choice. You can also find two more shows by our excellent colleagues, Seriously and the New Statesman podcast. In the meantime, you can find all the stories about cities, maps and geography you could ever possibly want on our website, citymetric.com. And since you've listened this far, leave us a nice review on iTunes, eh? Go on, we'll love you for it. Thanks for listening.
This is a Manhattan-bound B Express train. The next stop is Grand Street.
Mind the gap.
지하 서울역입니다. 내리실 문은 오른쪽입니다. 명동.